Denton reached into his jacket for a fresh clip for the Uzi, and I saw something across his belly that I noticed for future reference, should I have any future. I watched the killing, and I hid, and I prayed that there would be an opportunity to flee toward the open doors of the garage before Denton or Parker noticed me. It went on forever. Oh, I knew in some rational part of my brain that only seconds were going by, but it felt like days. I was terrified, and my head and my body hurt, and I couldn't use magic to protect myself. There was a sound near my ankle, and my heart leapt up out of my throat. I flinched violently away from it. The sound repeated itself in a continuous scrabble of noise. The floor, I noticed, was rough dirt and broken concrete in this corner, where the foundation was flawed. The scrabbling noise came from the very base of the wall, where the dirt was stirring and moving. Something was trying to dig its way beneath the wall and into the garage, practically right underneath my butt. I felt a chill of fear, followed swiftly by anger at the thing that had added to an already overabundant flow of adrenaline. I clutched my makeshift weapon in hand and moved to crouch over the source of the disturbance, lifting it in preparation to strike at whatever came through. I saw it in the dimness, and there was no mistaking the shape. A paw, a huge canine paw, scrabbling at the earth, digging out a shallow hole beneath the wall, frustrated by bits of concrete that had gotten in the way. Between shots I could hear animal sounds outside, panting whimpers of eagerness, it seemed. Whatever was out there wanted to dig its way inside, and it wanted it bad. "Dig this," I muttered, and swung the wrench down on the paw, hard. There was an instant yelp of pain, and the paw jerked its way back out from beneath the corrugated metal wall. It was followed by a snarl, and the paw appeared again, whereupon I slammed the wrench down on it once more, with similar results. I heard a furious snarling sound from the other side, and I released a small surge of vindictive satisfaction by leaning down close enough to the hole to say, "Ha! Bring another one in here and I'll give you the same." I heard sounds outside for a moment, then the crunch of gravel and Tara West's smooth, unmistakable voice. "Wizard," she hissed. "Stop that!" I blinked, startled, and leaned down close to the hole. "Tara? Is that you? How did you know it was me?"
"You are the only man I ever met," Tara growled, "who would smash the paws that are trying to free you from certain death."
I flinched at another burst of gunfire from the far side of the garage.
"I am going to tell them to dig again. Do not strike their paws."
"Them?" I demanded. "Them? Who?" But she didn't answer me. Instead, the scrabbling sounds began again. I looked over my shoulder at the rest of the room. I saw street wolves moving swiftly through the door at the gaping hole Marconi had left in the garage door when he escaped. In a flash of automatic muzzle fire, I saw Denton stand over the form of a lanky woman and firing down into it, apparently making absolutely certain she would never arise again. I had enough time to recognize Lana's face, now screwed up with pain rather than bloodlust. Her body jerked and twitched as Denton emptied the remainder of the clip into her, and then everything went black again. By my feet, the scrabbling sounds continued and then broke off in a yelp. I heard a series of vicious snarls and yelps from the half-dug hole beneath the wall, and I cursed.
"Tara,"
I whispered as loudly as I dared.
"What's going on?"
There was only more growling for answer and a sharp yelp that carried to the far side of the garage. I threw myself flat behind the toolbox in a pile of junk just before a flashlight beam swept over the corner where I was hiding.
"It's that bitch," Denton snarled. "Roger's got her outside."
There was a whispering sound and a tingling feeling along my spine. Then a throaty female voice purred.
"Parker's still here. So is that wizard. I can smell them."
"Damn it," Denton growled. "The wizard knows too much. Wilson, go help Roger."
"What about me, lover?" the female voice said, a husky little laugh added to the end.
Agent Ben sounded like she just had too much sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and was hungry for more.
"You and I stay here. I'll cover the doors. Flush them toward me."
There was a mewling sound of pleasure from the woman.
"Come with me," she urged. "Change. You know you'll love it so much. You'll know how good it feels."
I could visualize Denton's veins throbbing. It's smarter for one of us to cover the door with a gun. But there was a sort of heavy reluctance to his tone.
Fuck smart, Ben purred. Come with me. Change. It's not why we did this. Not why we made the bargain.
Ben made another sound, utterly sexual in nature.
It doesn't matter now. Taste it, she urged him. Taste the blood.
The light wavered and dropped from the corner where I hid. I chanced to look up. Agent Ben, spattered in gore, stood before Denton in a wash of his flashlight from the floor. She had three of her fingers pressed together and was sliding them between his lips. Denton was shaking, and his eyes were squeezed tightly closed. He sucked at her fingers, something frighteningly erotic in the motion. One of the huge, gaunt beasts from earlier, Wilson, I suppose, stood nearby, watching the pair of them with gleaming eyes. Denton made a growling sound and grasped Ben by her mane of gray hair, jerking her chin so that he could nuzzle and lick the blood smeared over her throat. She laughed and arched into him, her hips undulating against his urgent motions.
Change, she moaned. Change, do it.
There was a howl of rage and a flash of motion, and Parker staggered from the darkness, one arm dangling uselessly, a heavy knife in his other hand, and defiance and insane anger in his glazed eyes. Denton and Ben looked up. Then they reached to their waists, flickered, and changed into a pair of nightmare-sized wolves, their eyes glowing in the ambient light, jaws dropping open, revealing lolling tongues and vicious fangs. Parker lurched forward, greasy hair flying, and the three wolves leapt on him. I stared in a sort of sickened fascination. The wolves buried him under a mound of fangs and fur and blood in absolute fury. He screamed, the knife flailing, and it was cast aside out of his hands to land spinning on the floor not far from me. Parker tried to fight, tried to struggle up and kick, but it was all hopeless. There were flashes of blood, and he screamed again, and it went still. And then the wolves started to eat him. They bit off chunks of muscle and gulped them down, ripping aside clothing to get at more meat. They snarled and snapped at one another, and one of the males mounted the female, even as she continued to tear at the body, burrowing her muzzle down through the layers of stomach muscle to get at the vitals. My gorge rose, and if I had anything in my stomach, I would have emptied it onto the concrete floor. Instead, I turned back to the half-finished hole in the floor and started digging at it with my wrench, frantic. I didn't want to be the next thing on the menu. There were more yelps from outside, more growls, and I opened the hole up enough that I thought I might be able to get out. I flattened myself down and wormed my way into the dirt, the corrugated metal scraping at my back, my wounded shoulder paining me again. I jerked my way out into the open air, to find myself in an alley behind a garage, dimly lit by a distant street lamp. There were wolves everywhere. Three wolves, smaller than the ones I'd seen before, were spread in a loose ring about a great russet-furred beast with bat-like ears. The great wolf's coat was spattered with blood, and two of the smaller wolves lay nearby, yelping in pain still, stirring weakly, blood matted to their coats. Terror was part of the ring, around the great beast as well, naked and lean, a length of pipe held in either hand. When the great wolf turned toward one of the others, the rest would begin to close in on him, and he would spin again, jaws flashing, trying to pin down one of those who encircled him.
You took your time, wizard, Terra snarled without looking back at me.
I got to my feet, wrench in hand, and shook my head to clear it of cold sweat. Terra, I said, we've got to get out of here. Denton and the others will be coming.
Go, she responded. Help MacFin. We will hold them.
The great russet wolf lunged at her, and she skittered back, coolly staying a hair's breadth from his fangs. She fetched him a sharp blow across the nose with more speed than I could have believed, and a contemptuous snort. The three smaller wolves rushed the great beast, and he spun to drive them back and away from him, drawing a yelp from one that wasn't swift enough to entirely evade his jaws.
You can't stop them all, I said. There's three more like this one.
They are a pack on the ground, she snarled, and jerked her head toward the wounded wolves. We do not abandon our own. I let out an acid curse. I needed Tara. She could confirm everything, help me sort out all the facts, make sure I could understand what was going on. She was offering to give her life for me, to stay and occupy Denton and the others for as long as she could, and her compatriots could. But I had seen enough of people dying already tonight. I wasn't going to accept another loss on my behalf. And I was abruptly more furious than afraid. I've been run around and treated like a piece of baggage or a choice item on the menu for long enough. I flailed around in the dark and been helpless and ineffective for way too long. Too many people had been hurt, too much suffering caused by creatures of magic and the night, things that I should have been handling. It didn't matter to me at that moment that I couldn't work out any of my spells against them. I might not have magic available to me, but that didn't make me any less of a wizard. One of the magi, the wise. That's the true power of a wizard. I know things. Knowledge is power. With power comes responsibility. That made the entire thing pretty simple. I clutched the wrench in my hand, took a deep breath, and threw myself forward at the great wolf's back. The huge wolf sensed me coming, spun with abrupt speed, and met me in the air. It slammed me down on the concrete and bent its jaws toward my throat. I heard Tara cry out, and she and the other wolves moved forward, but they would never have been able to get the thing before it killed me. That wasn't the point. I jammed the wrench into the wolf's jaws, feeling some teeth tear at one of my fingers as I did. The wolf snarled and jerked the wrench out of my hands. It spun end over end away from me, and the great beast turned back toward me, its eyes glowing. I had time to watch it all in great detail. The wolf's power, its speed, simply shocked me. It was huge, quick, and I didn't have a prayer against it. The distant streetlight gleamed off its reddened fangs, and its muzzle sped toward my throat. Chapter 25. The wolf's fur was speckled with drops of blood that had beaded on it like rain. The gravel in the alley shone in a half-light from the distant street lamps. The wolf's muzzle, a little shorter and broader than I'd seen on Wild Kingdom, was drawn back, black lips from fangs striped white and red like peppermints. Its eyes were blue rather than any proper lupine shade and gleamed with a sort of demented awareness. I had time to see all those details because I didn't need my eyes for what I wanted to do. I thrust my hands into the beast's pelt as he went for my throat and wormed my way down between its forelegs with my buttocks, fingers digging, until I found what I was looking for. The sharp metal edges of a belt buckle down against the skin, almost flush to the surface. As the wolf's jaws came toward my throat, I furiously worked the buckle, feeling skin rip and tear from the wolf's hide as I jerked it open and threw my arm to one side, clutching hard at the trailing strap. And abruptly, a wolf pelt belt was sliding out from beneath the gray suit jacket of Roger Harris, the forensic specialist for the local FBI office, the kid with the red hair and the big ears. He crouched over me for a second, blinking in stunned amazement at me, blood on his mouth and lips. "Hexen Wolf, jerk off!" I snarled and slammed my knee up into his groin. It hit home hard. Harris gasped and rolled off me, reaching into his jacket, but I didn't let him get his gun. I stayed with him, keeping too close to him to let him move his arms freely, grabbing him by those big ears, and started slamming his head repeatedly against the gravel. He struggled against me for a few seconds, but I'd taken him by surprise. His skull banged against the rocks over and over, and after half a dozen solid blows, he stopped struggling. I released his ears with a little jerk and looked up at Tara and the wolves. They were closing in around him like a pack of sharks around a wounded dolphin, and I could read the blood in their eyes, the bared fangs, and the white-knuckled grip of Tara's hand on her lead pipes. I felt a sudden surge of frustration. Bad enough to have bloodthirsty animals roaming all over the city. I didn't need more of them on my team. "Everyone back off," I snarled. "He's ours," Tara answered me in kind. "He hurt those of the pack." "Then why don't you get them some help instead of wasting your time on this guy?" I said. His blood is ours, Tara said, and the wolves confirmed this with a chorus of angry growls. He can't hurt you now. Killing him won't make your friends any better, and the lost time might finish them. You do not understand, wizard, Tara snarled, and the wolves echoed her in a chorus, white fangs showing. It is our way. I stood up, slowly, to my full height. I understand, I said in a very low and even voice, that you do not want to make me any more angry than I already am. I met Tara's eyes and stared hard. My jaws ached from clenching. There's been enough killing. Take him out now, and you're no different than he is. Wrong, Tara said. I would be alive, and he's dead. Not if you cross me, you won't be. We held the tension for a moment, glaring at one another. I saw uncertainty waver over her face. She didn't know I was out of gas, magically speaking, and she'd seen me do too many impressive things with my powers to want to defy me lightly. She blinked first and looked away from me with a sullen sound in the back of her throat. As you wish, wizard, she said. We don't have time to waste fighting one another. The rest of his pack is coming, and we have wounded to tend to. I nodded and swept my gaze around at the three wolves around me. Anybody else? I challenged. They all backed away from me and didn't meet my eyes. All right, then, I said, and stooped to recover Harris's gun and the wolf pelt belt. Do you have any transportation out of here? Yes, said Tara, and barked an order. Georgia. One of the wolves, a leggy, lanky, pale brown beast, shuddered and paced in a circle, making small, whimpering sounds. A moment later there was a whisper of power, and the she-wolf shivered and went still, her head bowed. And then she shook herself, and all that pale brown hair faded from paler skin, leaving me staring at the lanky, dark blonde girl I had seen in the department store a few days ago, sans all the black leather. Georgia rose to her feet and said, I'll have her bring the van around on the next street. Can you get them into it? Her expression was tense and her eyes a little wide. Yes, Tara said. Everyone, come back to yourselves. And the other two ambulant wolves began to pace in a slow circle, gathering their own power, and their own transformations commenced, until they stood before me as a pair of naked young men, one of them the short, stout boy who had been arguing against Georgia, Billy, and the other, a face I recognized but couldn't name. Tara took charge of the situation while I held Harris's gun and kept watch down the alley. She and the two young men made a litter for one of the wolves out of Harris's jacket, and the other, Tara simply picked up with a flexion of wire-tight muscle and carried, though it must have weighed 150 pounds. The wounded wolves yelped piteously, and Tara and the two young men cast dark glances at the downed Harris while they headed down the alley and over to the beach, leaving me alone with the kid. I hunkered down beside him and slapped his face until his eyes rolled open. He blinked once and then jerked, as though he was about to sit up. I stuck the barrel of the semi-automatic in the hollow of his throat and said, in a calm voice, "Hold still." He froze, staring up at me with wide eyes. I'm going to ask you some questions, kid. I think I've got the answers already, but you're going to talk to me quietly and honestly. Or I demonstrate point-blank bullet impact for you right here and now. Got it? Harris's mouth twitched a few times before he managed to speak. If you kill me, he said, Denton won't stop until you're dead. Give me a break, Roger, I said back in a reasonable tone. Denton wants me dead anyway. I could kill you now and it wouldn't make any difference in what he has to do. Roger licked his lips and rolled his eyes about without moving his head, as though hoping for rescue. How did you know about the belt? I saw Denton inside, and I saw that before you all changed. And I saw that before you all changed, you had reached inside your jackets for something. I figured that first night Agent Ben was reaching into her jacket to touch the belt and tear Murphy's head off when she got mad, but she managed to remember not to do it in time and drew her gun instead, right? Harris's head twitched in a slight nod. The bargain, I said. You're Hexenwolfen. So you've made a bargain with someone to get the power to change, to get the belts. Who is it? I don't know, Harris said, and his eyes widened. God, I don't know. Denton handled all of it. I narrowed my eyes at him and drew back the hammer of a gun. Please, he squealed breathlessly. I don't know. I swear to God, Denton handled all of that. He just came to us, asked us if we wanted to back him, if we wanted to nail some of the scum that kept getting away from the law, and I told him I did. Jesus, I didn't know it was going to lead to this.
Lead to what, Roger? I said, my tone frosty. Start from the beginning and make it quick.
Marconi, he said, his eyes on the gun in my hand. It was all about Marconi. Denton wanted to take him down.
You mean kill him? His eyes flickered up to me.
He told us there was no other way to get him, that he was doing more to poison the city than anyone alive. And he was right. Marconi's brought enough influence in this town to stay clear of the city police forever, and he carries weight on the national level, too. The Bureau has had more than one investigation on him called off. He's untouchable.
So you plan to use the belts to kill him?
He nodded. But there would be evidence. No one would believe he'd just been mauled by wild dogs. There would be full investigations, forensics, the works.
I understood and nodded. So you needed someone to make it a neat package. Let me guess. The street wolves.
Harris showed his teeth.
A gang of felons and troublemakers with a wolf motif. Murder of a criminal figure by persons with a wolf motif. No one would bother to check the figures on that one. It's obvious. And we get one more dangerous group off the street.
Yeah, Roger. Except that they'd be innocent of that particular crime.
Did you think of that?
Innocent, like those other people who died those nights around the full moon last month. You killed them. You and the rest of Denton's team.
He closed his eyes, his face going pale, and he shuddered.
The change. When you're changed, when you're a beast, it's so incredible. So much speed, power. Your body just sings with it. I tried coke once in college, and it was nothing compared to this. The blood.
His tongue flicked out again, over his blood-stained lips, a thirsty motion this time, rather than a nervous one.
I think I'm starting to see. Denton didn't tell you about that part, about how your thoughts are influenced. He probably didn't know himself. And once you've done it once, Harris nodded emphatically, you just can't stop it, man. It gets to where you're pacing the room at night. And it's better than sleep. When you get finished hunting, you feel so alive.
He opened his eyes again, staring up at me, pleading.
I didn't mean to kill those people. We started off with criminals, some gangsters dealing drugs. We were just going to scare them, but it was too much. They screamed and ran, and we ran after them, and we killed them. And, my God, Dresden, it was beautiful.
And it happened again, I said, a couple of times. Innocent people, just poor schmucks in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Harris turned his head away from me and nodded. Denton said that we could salvage it. He said that we could pin those killings on the street wolves as well, make everyone think that they had done it, and we just went along with them.
I shook my head.
That doesn't explain why you dragged McFinn into this.
Denton, he said.
It was all him. He said there was someone else who we could also set up to take the blame, to be certain we'd be in the clear, that he had a man for it. He broke into McFinn's house, and there was all this occult stuff. We messed up some of it and left, and the next night more people were dead. And more the next night. That's why we went after that slime Marconi's business partner and wasted the bastard and his goon.
And then you laid low for a month.
Harris swallowed and nodded. Denton took the belts. He hid them from us. He'd held out better than anyone. And my God, poor Ben was gone so far. It was like she wasn't even human anymore. Wilson wasn't much better, but we lasted out the month.
And then you killed Marconi's bodyguard at the varsity.
Harris's eyes flared.
Yes. You should see his record. The things we know he did, but we couldn't get through to court.
My God, Dresden, he had it coming.
Maybe, maybe not. Who are we to judge?
Who are we not to? Harris demanded. The power was in our hands. We had the responsibility to use it for good, to do our jobs. Hell, Dresden, if you're such a do-gooder, you should be helping us, not getting in our way. These men are untouchable, and you know it.
I shifted my weight uncomfortably. I don't agree with your methods, with setting people up to take blamings for your killings. Harris sneered.
Mike McFinn has never killed anyone. Hell, he's a murderer now, isn't he? After that scene at the police station, anyone would be convinced he was a killer.
Except me, I said. McFinn would never have been there if you hadn't messed up the circle that held him.
Yeah, Harris said, a spiteful, frustrated edge to his tone. Except you. You gotta poke around in our business. Christ, that crazy report to Murphy even talked about the belts. That was when Denton started to take you seriously. If you had any brains at all, you'd pull that trigger and get the hell out now, before Denton and the others come out of the haze and come after you, because you know way too much.
Why the street wolves, I said, instead of shooting him. Why send me off to check them out?
Denton figured they'd kill you, Harris spat, and get you out of our hair.
I nodded. It figured that someone else had been trying to kill me the whole time, and I hadn't really noticed.
And he knew they were after me, after I got away from them the first time.
Yeah, and had me tailing them so we could find you and make sure you were dead. When I saw you in the back of the car, I figured you were. So we planned to hit on the street wolves to go down tonight, before McFinn went to Marconi.
How did you know about that? I asked.
Harris snorted.
Marconi told us. The snake called asking for police protection.
I almost smiled.
Did he get it?
Hell no, Harris answered me. He lifted his chin and balled his hands into fists, and I felt them tighten up beneath me.
I'm done talking, he said. If you aren't going to sign on with us, then get the hell out of here, or pull the trigger, but quit wasting time.
I'm not done talking, I said, and I jammed the gun crosswise over the kid's throat, strangling him. You're going to give Denton a message for me. I'm sick of dancing around. Tell him he'll get his shot at me at moonrise at Marconi's place.
Harris squirmed beneath me, making rasping, gagging sounds. His eyes widened at my words.
It doesn't take a genius to figure out that he'll try to be there when McFinn shows up, I said. That he'll want to make sure everyone there is dead, so he's the only one who can report what happened. You tell him that I'll be there. And tell him that he's not going to get away with it. Do you understand me, kid?
I let up on the pressure, and Harris croaked out a vague affirmative. I rose away from him, keeping the gun in one hand and the belt in the other. I saw his eyes flicker to the belt, tracking its movement with a tense, strained sort of hunger.
Why tell me? The kid asked. Why warn us?
I stared down at him for long seconds before I answered him in a quiet voice.
Because I don't like what you are doing. What you are. You aren't using the power you've been given. It's using you. You are turning into animals. You're using savagery and fear to try to uphold peace. Now it's your turn to see what it's like to be afraid.
Harris rose to his feet, his red hair askew, blood drying on his mouth, and backed away several paces from me, his eyes darting around.
My belt, he said. I want my belt.
Forget it, kid, I told him. The smartest thing you can do is go lock yourself in a room and stay there until all of this is over. Because one way or another, you aren't using this belt again.
His face whitened, and he took a step toward me. I pointed the gun at him, and he froze, his hands balling into fists.
You won't get away with this, he said, his voice thick with tension.
Moonrise, I told him, then turned on my heel and walked quickly from the alley, although my sock feet on the gravel, combined with my limp, probably spoiled the badass image. 30 feet down the alley, Tara appeared from the shadows and fell into step beside me, close enough to support me if I should fall.
You were wrong, wizard, she said.
I glanced down at her, and she met my gaze with her soulless amber eyes.
How so?
They have not become animals. She looked over her shoulder. Her eyes narrowed. Animals do not do what they have done. Animals kill to eat, to defend themselves or their own, and to protect their territory. Not for the joy of it. Not for the lust of it. She looked back at me. Only humans do that, wizard.
I grimaced, but couldn't really refute her. I guess you're right.
Of course, Tara said. We walked in silence for a moment.
Will you try to help my fiancé?
I'll try, I said, but I can't let his curse claim any more lives. She nodded, her eyes dark.
He would want it that way. He thinks of others before himself.
He sounds like a good man. She shrugged, but there was a sudden worried weight in her shoulders.
And these others, the FBI, they will try to stop you?
Yes.
And when they do?
I can't let them go on like they have. They're out of control. I don't think they can stop themselves from killing now. I didn't look down at Tara, I just focused on taking steps, one at a time.
When they do, I said, when they do, I guess I'm going to need to get very human.
Chapter 26. Tara and I walked toward the shores of Lake Michigan. There, along 49th Street, idled a big old van, its engine rattling. Its headlights came on as we approached, and the driver came out and rolled open the side door for us.
Harry, she said. Oh, God, what did they do to you?
She hurried over to me, and I felt Susan's warmth against me as she slid one of my arms over her shoulder and pressed up against my side. She was wearing jeans that showed off her long legs and a dark red jacket that complemented her dark skin. Her hair was tied back into a ponytail, and it made her neck look slender and vulnerable. Susan felt soft and warmed beyond relief and smelled clean and delightfully feminine, and I found myself leaning against her. All the aches and pains that had faded into the background came throbbing back into the forefront of my awareness in comparison to her soft warmth and gentle support. I liked the way Susan felt better than the way I did.
They beat him, Tara explained, but they kept him alive, as I told you they might.
Your face looks like a sack of purple potatoes, Susan said, her dark eyes studying me, the lines in her face deepening.
You say the sweetest things, I mumbled.
They loaded me into the van where Georgia, Billy, and the other alphas were crouched. Two of the young people, a boy with blinking, watery blue eyes, and a girl with mousy brown hair, lay on their backs, gasping quietly. Clean white bandages had been wrapped around their wounds. Georgia had, evidently, been the attending medic. All of the alphas were dressed in plain, dark bathrobes rather than their birthday suits, and I felt an oddly grateful feeling toward them for it. Things were weird enough without needing to ride around in a van with a bunch of naked, somewhat geeky college students. I put my seatbelt on and noted the bruises on my hand and forearms as I did. Ugly, dark purple and brown splotches, so thickly scattered over my skin that in places I couldn't tell where one stopped and the next began. I sat down and leaned against the window, pillowing my head on my right hand.
"What are you doing with these people?" I asked Susan when she got into the driver's seat.
"Driving," she said. "I was the only one old enough to rent the van."
I winced.
"Ouch."
"Tell me about it," she said, and started the engine. "After you jumped out of the car, and I finished with my heart attack, we called the police, just like you said. Tara went to look for you and told me that the police had shown up too late and that the street wolves had taken you."
"How did that truck crash like that?"
"Bad luck. Someone made all their tires explode at the same time."
Susan gave me an arch look and started up the van.
"Those bastards. Just lie still, Harry. You look like a train wreck. We gotta get you someplace quiet."
"Food," I said. "I'm starving.
Tara, can you keep track of moonrise?"
"I will," she said. "The clouds are moving away. I can see the stars."
"Fantastic," I mumbled. And then I went to sleep, ignoring the jostling of the van. I didn't wake up until the smell of fried grease and charred meat made me look up at the drive-through window of the fast-food burger joint. Susan paid for everything in cash, passing paper sacks to everyone. I snagged a golden paper crown from one of the bags and idly joined it into a circle and put it on my head. Susan blinked at me, then let out a brief laugh.
"I am," I intoned with an imperious narrowing of my eyes, "the Burger King."
Susan laughed again, shaking her head, and Tara gave me a serious, level gaze. I checked the status of the young people in the back of the van and found them, even the wounded ones, hungrily wolfing, no pun intended, down the food. Tara caught the direction of my glance, leaned toward me. "Puppies," she said, as though the word should explain more than it did. "They were not hurt so badly as they thought. They will hardly have scars to show for it." "That's good to know," I said, and started sipping at my cola and chomping down hot, steaming French fries. "But what I'm really interested in," I said, "is knowing why your blood was in Marconi's restaurant the night before the full moon." Tara took a hamburger patty off the bun and started nibbling on it, holding it in her fingers. "Ask another time." "No offense," I said, "but I'm not so sure there's going to be another time, so tell me." Tara took another bite of meat and then shrugged. "I knew that the pack that had harassed my fiancé was about. I deducted where they might strike, and went there to attempt to stop them."
"All by yourself?" Tara sniffed.
"Most of those people who turn themselves into wolves know little about being wolf wizard. But these had taken too much of the beast inside. I ran through the window glass and fought, but they outnumbered me. I left before I could be killed."
"And what about these kids?" I said, nodding toward the back of the van.
She glanced back at them, and for a moment I saw warmth and a pride gleaming in her eyes, subverting the remote alien lines of her face. "Children, but with strong hearts. They wish to learn, and I taught. Let them tell their tale."
"Maybe later," I said, and finished off the French fries. "Where are we going?"
"To a safe place, to arm and prepare ourselves."
"Myself," I corrected her, "to prepare myself. I'm not taking you with me."
"You are incorrect," Tara said. "I am going with you."
"No." She fastened her amber eyes on mine.
"You are strong, wizard, but you have not yet seen my beast. The men you will oppose will take my fiancé from me. I will not allow that. I will be with you, or you will have to kill me to stop me."
This time, it was me who looked away first. I sipped my drink, scowling, while Tara placidly ate more of hamburger patty.
"Who are you?" I asked her finally. "One who has lost too many of her family already," she said. And then she settled back on the seat and withdrew from the conversation, falling silent.
"One who has lost too many," I grumbled, frustrated, mocking her beneath my breath. I turned back to the front of the van and hunched my shoulders over my burger. "Put some clothes on, you weird, yellow-eyed, table-dancing, werewolf-training, cryptic, stare-me-right-in-the-eyes and don't even blink, wench." There was a hissing sound from the back seat, and I flicked a scowl over my shoulder. Tara was chewing on her meat. Her eyes were shining, her mouth was curved at the corners, and her breath was puffing out of her nostrils in near-silent laughter. The safe place we were going to turned out to be a big house up near the Gold Coast, not far from Marconi's own mini-palace. The house wasn't large, but by the neighborhood standards, that was like saying that the bale of hay isn't much to eat, by elephant standards. Susan drove the van up through a break in the high hedge, up a long driveway of white concrete, and into the six-car garage, whose doors rolled majestically up before us. I got out of the van in the garage and stared at the Mercedes and the Suburban also parked there. "Where are we?" I said. Tara opened the door of the van, and Georgia, Billy, and the other young men emerged, assisting the two wounded werewolves out. Georgia stretched, which did interesting things to the dark bathrobe, and drew her mane of tawny hair back from her lean face with one hand.
"It's my parents' place. They're in Italy for another week."
I rubbed a hand over my face.
"They aren't going to mind you having a party, are they?"
She flashed me an annoyed little look and said,
"Not as long as we clean up all the blood. Come on, Billy. Let's get these two inside and into bed."
"You go on," he said, fastening his eyes on me. "I'll be along in a minute." Georgia looked like she wanted to give him an argument, but shook her head and, with the help of the other young man, helped the two invalids inside. Tara, still naked and supremely unconcerned about it, followed them, glancing back over her shoulder at me before she disappeared. Susan promptly stepped in front of me, somewhat obstructing the view, and said,
5 minutes, Dresden. Come and find me then."
Oh, was my rapier reply, and then Susan went into the house, too. I stood there in the dark with Billy, the stout, short kid in thick glasses. He had his hands stuffed into his bathrobe pockets, and he was peering at me. "Do all wizards," he said, "get kitty crowns and wear them around, or is it only for special occasions?" "Do all werewolves," I shot back, snatching the crown from my head, "wear glasses and too much old spice, or is that only for full moons?" He grinned at me, rather than taking umbrage. "You're quick," he said. "I always wanted to be that way." He stuck out his hand toward me. "Billy Borden." I traded grips with him wearily, and he tried to crush my hand in his. "Harry Dresden," I told him. "You look pretty beat up, Mr. Dresden," he said. "Are you sure you can handle going out again tonight?" "No," I answered, in a spurt of brutal honesty. Billy nodded and pushed his glasses up higher onto his nose. "Then you need our help." Oh, good grief. The Mickey Mouse Club of Werewolves wanted to throw in on my side. Werewolf taker roll call. Billy, Georgia, Tommy, Cindy. Sheesh. "No way," I said. "Absolutely not." "Why not?" he said. "Look, kid, you don't even know what these Hexenwolfen can be like. You don't know what Marconi can be like, and you sure as hell have never seen anything like McFinn outside of a movie theater. And even if you had the skills to deal with it, what makes you think you have the right to be going along?" Billy considered the question seriously. "The same thing that makes you think you do, Mr. Dresden," he said. I opened my mouth and closed it again. "I know I don't know a lot compared to you," Billy said, "but I'm not stupid. I've got eyes. I see some things everyone else tries to pretend aren't there. This vampire craze sweeping the nation. Why the hell shouldn't there be some genuine vampires in it? Did you know that violent crimes have increased nearly 40% in the last 3 years, Mr. Dresden? Murder alone has doubled, particularly in heavy urban areas and isolated rural areas. Abductions and disappearances have gone up nearly 300%. I blinked at the kid. I hadn't really read the numbers. I knew that Murphy and some of the other cops said that the streets were getting worse, and I knew myself, on some deep level, that the world was getting darker. Hell, it was one of the reasons I did idiotic things like I was doing tonight, my own effort to lift up the torch. I'm sort of a pessimist, Mr. Dresden. I think that people are almost too incompetent to hurt themselves too badly. I mean, if criminals were trying, they couldn't increase their production by 300%. And I hear stories, read the tabloids sometimes. So what if the supernatural world is making a comeback? What if that accounts for some of what is going on? What if it does? I asked him. Billy regarded me steadily, without looking me in the eyes. Someone has to do something. I can, so I should. That's why we're here, the Alphas. Tara offered us a chance to do something when she met us through the Northwest Passage Project, and we took it. I stared at the kid. I could have argued with him, but there wouldn't be much point to it. I knew his argument, backward and forward. I worked it out myself. If I was 10 years younger, a foot shorter, and a couple of pounds heavier, that could have been me talking. And I had to admit, the kid did have power. I mean, turning yourself into a wolf is no cheap parlor trick. But I did have one angle to play, and I took it. I didn't want this kid's blood on my hands. I don't think you're ready for the big leagues yet, Billy. Could be, he said, but there's no one else in the bullpen. I had to give the kid credit. He had resolve. Maybe you should sit this one out and live to fight another day. It could all go bad, and if it does, those Hexenwolfen we took on down by the beach are going to be coming for you. Someone will need to stay with your wounded people and protect them. More likely, if they go through you, they're going to go through us, too. It would be smarter to pile on everything we've got in one place, with you. I chuckled. All your eggs in one basket? He shook his head. All the money on the most likely winner. I studied him in a silence for a long minute. I was confident of his sincerity. It just oozed out of him in a way that only the really inexperienced and idealistic can manage. It was comforting. and at the same time it was the most frightening thing about him. His ignorance. No, not ignorance, really. Innocence. He didn't know what he was going out to face. If I let him go along, I'd be dragging him down with me. Despite what he'd seen tonight, I'd be exposing him to a whole new, violent, bloody, and dangerous world. One way or another, if I let Billy Borden and his buddies go with me, these innocent children wouldn't live to see the sunrise. But God help me, he was right about one thing. I needed the help. Everyone who's going takes orders from me, I said, and he drew in a sharp breath, his eyes gleaming. Not Tara. You do what I say, you do it when I say it. And if I tell you to leave, you go. No questions. You got it? I got it, Billy said, and he gave me a cocky grin that simply did not belong on the face of a geeky college nerd in a black bathrobe. You're a smart man, Mr. Dresden. I snorted at him. And just then, the automatic light on the garage door opener went out, leaving us in darkness. There was a disgusted sound from the doorway, and then the lights came on again. Georgia, in all her willowy, annoyed glory, was standing in the doorway to the garage. Billy Borden, she said. Don't you have any better sense than to stay here in the dark? She stalked out toward him, scowling. He looked up at her calmly and said, Tell everyone we're going along. Dresden's in charge. If they can handle that, they're in. And if not, they're staying here to guard Cindy and Alice. Georgia's eyes widened and she gave a little whoop of excitement. She turned toward me and threw her arms around me for a moment, making my shoulders scream in pain, and then whirled to Billy and bent down to do the same thing. He winced when she did, and she stood up and jerked back his black bathrobe, clearing it off to one side of his pale chest. To give the kid credit, his stoutness was the result of what looked like quite a bit of solid muscle, and along the line of his chest there was a thickly clotted wound, still trickling blood in a few places. What's this? Georgia said. You idiot. You didn't tell me you'd gotten hurt. Billy shrugged and pulled his robe straight again. It closed, and you can't bandage it and keep it on me when I change, anyway. Georgia clucked her teeth, annoyed. You shouldn't have gone for the hamstring on that wolf. He was too fast. Billy flashed her a grin. I almost got him, though. You almost got yourself killed, she said, but her voice had softened a few shades. I noticed that she hadn't moved her hand from the side of Billy's chest, and he was looking up at her with an expectant expression. She fell silent, and they stared at one another for a minute. I saw her swallow. Please help me, young werewolves in love. I turned to walk into the house, moving carefully. I never much believed in God. Well, that's not quite true. I believed that there was a God, or something close enough to warrant the name. If there were demons, there had to be angels, right? If there was a devil, somewhere there had to be God. But he and I had never really seen things in quite the same terms. All the same, I flashed up a look at the ceiling. I didn't say any words, not even inside. But if God was listening, I hope he got the message nonetheless. I didn't want any of these children getting themselves killed. Chapter 27. Susan's perfume led me to her. She was waiting for me in a bedroom on the first floor. She stood in the simply furnished room, her jeans and the white t-shirt blazoned with the words, Eat it? I wouldn't sit on it. It was one of mine. She lifted her chin up high as she saw me, as though trying to keep the tears in her eyes from falling. Our gazes met and held. We had looked into one another before. More than a year ago. She'd fainted when she saw what was inside of me through the soul gaze. I don't know what it was she saw. I don't look too hard into mirrors. Inside of her, though, I'd seen passion, like I'd rarely known in people other than myself. The motivation to go, to do, to act. It was what drove her forward, digging up stories of the supernatural for a half-comic rag like the Arcane. She had a gift for it, for digging down into the muck that people tried to ignore, and coming up with facts that weren't always easily explained. She made people think. It was something personal for her. I knew that much. But not why. Susan was determined to make people see the truth. I shut the door behind me and limped toward her. "They'll kill you," she said. "Don't go." As I reached her, she put her hands against my chest, then her cheek. "I've got to. Denton can't afford to let me live now. I need to finish this business before it gets any more out of hand. Before more people die. If I don't go tonight, Denton will be able to kill Marconi and McFinn and set McFinn up for all the killings. He'll get away clean, and then he'll be able to focus on me. And maybe you, too." "We can go somewhere," she said quietly. "We could hide." I blinked my eyes closed. She'd said we. She hadn't really done that much before. I hadn't really thought in those terms either. I hadn't much thought in those terms for a lot of years. Not since the last time. I should have said something about it, acknowledged the implication. I knew it was there, and she knew that I'd noticed it. She held still, waiting. Instead, I said, "I'm not much good at hiding. Neither are you." Her breath went out a little whisper, and I felt her tighten a little against me. There would be tears on my shirt, I knew, but I didn't look down at her. "You're right," she said a moment later. Her voice was shaking. "And I know you are, but I'm afraid, Harry. I mean, I know we haven't been really close friends and lovers, but..." "Work," I said. I closed my eyes. She nodded. "Work." Her fingers tightened on my shirt, and she looked up at me, dark eyes swimming with tears, still more on the smooth lines of her cheek. "I don't want to lose you now. I don't want the work to be all that's left." I tried to think of something smart to say, something that would reassure her, calm her, help her feel better, to understand what I felt for her. But I wasn't even sure what it was that I felt. I found myself kissing her, the rough growth on my mouth and chin brushing her soft skin. She tensed at first, and then melted against me with a deliciously feminine sort of willingness, a soft abandonment of distance that left her body in all its dark beauty pressed against mine. The kiss deepened, slowed, became something intense and erotic and self-contained. The motion of our lips, the warmth of our bodies pressed together, the touch of my fingertips on her face, feather light, the scratch of her nails as her fingers kneaded my shirt. My heart was pounding, and I could feel hers, too, racing. She broke the kiss first, and I swayed on my feet, my breath gone. Without speaking, she guided me down to the edge of the bed and sat me there. Then she vanished into the bathroom, reappearing with a basin of warm water, some soap, and a washcloth. She undressed me, slowly, delicately. She changed the bandages, murmuring softly to me when it hurt, kissing my eyes and forehead to soothe me. She bathed me with the water, its warmth washing away the dried sweat, the blood, and some of the pain. Patiently, more gentle than rain, she made me clean while I drifted, my eyes closed. I could hear myself make a soft sound now and then in response to her touches. I felt her come to me, felt her bare skin against mine, hot and smooth. I opened my eyes and saw the silver haze of the moon on the far horizon across the lake. I saw Susan outlined in it, all sweetly feminine curves and lines, a beautiful shadow. She kissed me again, and I returned it in kind. And it was a liquid, smooth thing, as restrained and desperate as the near-still surface of a rushing river. Her lips passed from my mouth and roamed over the skin she had just cleaned, and when I tried to touch her, she gently pressed my hands back down, telling me without words to be still. It went on like that, all skin and light touches, soft sighs, pounding hearts, until she settled atop me, keeping her weight off me with her legs, her hands afraid to cause any pain. We moved together, feeling the power of our need, our hunger for one another, a pure blend of desire and warmth and affection and incredible intimacy that shook us to the core. It ended in silence. the sensation all the more piercing for that. Our mouths together, our breaths mingling. She lay down beside me until our pounding hearts slowed down. And then she rose and said, "I don't know if I want to fall in love with you, Harry. I don't know if I could stand it." I opened my eyes and answered softly, "I've never wanted to hurt you. I don't know what's right." "I know it feels right," she said, and kissed me again, then started touching my forehead, lifting her head back to study me with gentle, compassionate eyes. "You see so much pain. I just wanted to remind you that there was something else in the world." I'm a pretty tough guy. I mean, look at me. I can handle some rough stuff, but some things I'm not so tough about. I started crying hard, and Susan held me, rocked me gently until the tears had gone away. I wanted to stay there, where it was warm, where I was clean, and where there wasn't anyone dying. There wasn't any blood or snarling animals, and no one was trying to kill me. I liked the idea of being there with Susan in her arms a whole lot more than I liked the idea of going out into the silver light of the full moon, which was growing greater underneath the horizon, coming up in a hazy nimbus. Instead, I drew away from her a little and sat up. It was a fool's moon. She rose and went to an overnight bag, returning with it, and drew out a pair of my black jeans, my black sneakers, socks, a heavy, dark gray shirt, dark undies to complete the color theme, and bless her heart, ibuprofen. I rose to dress, but she pressed a hand on my shoulder and made me sit down, and then dressed me herself, slowly and carefully, her attention focused on the task. Neither of us spoke. "Ever had a beautiful, naked woman dress you? Talk about girding your loins for battle. There was something indescribably soothing and at the same time exciting about it. I could feel my body becoming more relaxed and aware, my senses more in tune with what was around me. I heard footsteps in the hall and a knock at the door. Tara's voice called, "Wizard, it is time." I stood up, but Susan grabbed my wrist. "Harry," she said, "wait a minute." She knelt down by the bag and drew out a heavy box, flat and broad. "I was going to give it to you for your birthday, but I thought you could use it." I tilted my head and took the box in hand. It was heavy. "What is it?" I asked her. "Just open it, dummy," she answered, smiling up at me. I did, and inside was the smell of soft, worked leather, sensuous and thick, wrapped up in translucent paper. I tossed the lid aside, took the paper out, and found dark leather, new and matte black, hardly casting back the light. I took it out of the box, and it unfolded into a heavy, long coat, like my own duster in design, even to the mantle around the shoulders and arms, but it was made of the finer material. I blinked at the coat. "It must have cost you a fortune." She laughed wickedly. "Yeah, but I got to wear it around naked, just to feel it on my skin." Her face sobered. "I want you to have it, Harry. Something for me, for luck." She glided to my side and helped me slide into the coat. The coat settled around me with a comforting heaviness and a peculiar sort of familiarity. It felt just right. I plucked my mother's pentacle from its chain from beneath my shirt and wore it openly. And I got Harris's confiscated sidearm from my coveralls tool pouch and put it in the coat's pocket. I didn't have any other magical tools, and maybe not any more magic. The gun, all things considered, seemed to be an uncertain weapon, at best. But I was as ready as I was going to be. I turned to say goodbye to Susan, to find her hurriedly stepping into her clothes. "What are you doing?" I asked. "Getting dressed," she said. "Why?" "Someone's got to drive the van, Dresden." She tugged on her T-shirt, slung her jacket over her shoulder, and walked past me, pausing to give me a narrow glance. "Besides, this could be the biggest paranormal event I've ever had a chance to cover. Did you expect me to stay behind?" She pushed the door open and gave me an expectant look. "Damn," I thought, "and double damn. One more person to worry about. One more person to protect. Susan wasn't a werewolf. She wasn't a wizard. She didn't even have a gun. It was crazy to let her even think about going along. But I found